Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As we approach the end of the year and all the football bowl games, we're using Sound Ideas to reflect back on the year in sports in Bloomington Normal. Let's start with, well, why not? Football. High school parents have made football a part of their Friday nights as long as anyone can remember. But in recent years, participation in the sport has dropped noticeably. Concerns about player safety and socioeconomic factors raise worries about the sport's long-term prospects, especially in communities with deep football traditions and culture. GLT's Eric Stock examined the future of high school football efforts to make the game safer and how schools and communities are adjusting.
As you drive into the small farming community of Lexington, you quickly get a sense for the town's pride in its school and its sports teams. A large sign off the main road trumpets its athletic achievements, 15 state championships in high school and junior high sports. On a cold, windy, and rainy night in September, fans from all over northern McLean County, including rival El Paso Gridley, make their way to Lexington High School to take part in a Friday night ritual that's as much religion as it is sport in much of America.
Welcome, everyone, to Lexington for the home opener for the Lexington Ridgeview Mustangs.
It's a special night in Lexington because the football game their team is about to play is the only game Lexington will host all season. That's because Lexington no longer has a team of its own. 6 years after the Minutemen played in the state championship game, and 4 years after its star quarterback Alex Tanney was drafted into the National Football League, the school, which boasted 5 state title game appearances, no longer had enough players to field its own team. Eager to hold on to the sport, Lexington agreed to co-op arrangements with the 2 consolidated school districts, Ridgeview and Blue Ridge, so students who want to play football ride the bus an additional 40 minutes each day just to practice, just to have a football team. The 3-school co-op lasted just 1 season. Coach Jay Kennedy took over the program in 2016 after 3 straight winless seasons at Ridgeview, where he served as an assistant. The job was open for 3 months and no one applied before the athletic director applied some pressure on him to take the job.
Rodney had actually said, you know, Jake, if you take the head coach, I'll be the offense coordinator. I said, okay, I'll work with you, Coach Keller. We coached together for 12 years now. Well, I took the head job, but he backed out as the offense coordinator.
Ridgeview has since dropped Blue Ridge from the co-op because it became too cumbersome, but Kennedy has actually increased numbers in the football program. Ridgeview started the season with 53 players in all high school levels, with 16 of them from Lexington.
The cliche is, oh, if you win, kids will come out. Well, that's not always true because, you know, we've only been 3-6. I think if you get the right kids to come out, they'll bring other kids with them. And then there's a vibe, and then there's energy in your schools about, hey, football's good to go. Like, you should play it. And cool kids are playing football.
Kennedy adds he still has to allay concerns from parents who are worried about their child suffering a concussion.
But that could happen in basketball. It could happen in soccer. You can take a fastball to the head in baseball. You're going to get concussed. I mean, if it happens, it happens. It's no different than a broken ankle or a broken leg doing any other sport. But it is a tough sell right now in football. That's kind of the elephant in the room.
While the co-op between former rivals has kept football alive in both communities, to some, it has still diminished the community sense of identity.
The fence mending it's been good, and it's like anything. You're going to have your established people that they don't want to see change. But you hope that as you sell it and kids are more taking part of it and the communities come together, that will go away. But it will never 100% be gone.
Jamie Farrell is president of the Lexington Booster Club and was a cheerleader during her days at the high school. Her son played in the last Lexington football team as a freshman in 2014, but decided not to return after the co-op was formed.
Getting used to it, getting used to the new normal, getting used to the fact that Lexington doesn't have a football team, it's a challenge. So, you know, it's just It's just tough right now, you know, but hopefully people are going to start to buy into it a little bit more.
As Farrell helps set up food and drinks at the concession stand prior to kickoff, Farrell said she longs for the day that fans will see the Ridgeview Lexington Mustangs as their own.
People just aren't coming out like they used to and stuff, so I hope that we can, you know, kind of bring it back and people get a little bit more used to it, more comfortable with it.
The transition may be easier for some families who are less invested in the community's past. Polly Walcott grew up in Peoria before moving to Lexington in 2000 to raise her children. Her son Tate plays in the football team and is a state champion long jumper. She admits it was easier for her to see the practical benefits of the co-op because she lacked the strong connection many in the community had with Lexington's high school. Still, she and her family wondered if it was time to explore other options as the school's enrollment continued to dwindle and athletic opportunities were jeopardized.
So there was a time when they were talking about us consolidating with whoever and years ago, and we thought, do we need to move? Do we want to try to find a new town to go to? And no, we wanted to stay here. We like Lexington.
Son Tate Walcott quit football after his freshman year to his mother's relief. When friends talked him into rejoining the team for his senior season, she worried he would get hurt and risk his scholarship potential as a track standout.
Oh, yeah. I have some hesitation now. I mean, it's constant prayers that he won't get hurt.
More school districts like Lexington and Ridgeview are forming cooperatives as a way to have enough student-athletes to field the team, but even co-ops aren't enough in some places. Flanagan's high school football program pulls in students from three school districts. Yet in a game in early October, the Falcons had to quit at halftime because they didn't have enough players after several got injured and several others had recently quit the team. The National Federation of State High School Associations reports football participation has dropped 17% in Illinois over the last 5 years, and there are 18 fewer high schools sponsoring football. And while McLean County's population has marginally grown since the 2010 census, many rural school districts are shrinking. Six of the eight public school districts based in McLean County have seen decreased enrollment in the last 15 years, even after they absorbed students from two school districts that no longer exist. Chenoa was annexed into the Prairie Central School District in 2004. Gridley merged with El Paso that same year. Rural schools have seen the largest drops in K-12 enrollment since 2002. Olympia's headcount down nearly 26%. Lexington has fallen 19%, and Ridgeview's enrollment down 15%. It's been said that if the mothers of America wanted, they could kill football on their own, simply by taking their children off the field or never letting them on it in the first place. It appears a growing number of parents aren't letting their children play what is still the most popular spectator sport in the U.S. Chris Peacock of Lexington grew up in the classic American football family. She and her dad spent every fall Sunday watching their beloved Chicago Bears.
Mike Ditka, hungry Chicago. Finally, champions.
Her brother quarterbacked the Lexington High School team into the state playoffs in the early 90s. But over the last decade, her sentiments toward the game she once loved changed as she read more reports about ex-players suffering from brain injuries.
The stories of some, you know, juniors say, there's been some college kids who've had difficulties with mental illness and committing suicide and from the CTE, and it just kind of ruins the fun after a while.
Sayal was an NFL Hall of Fame linebacker who committed suicide in 2012. Doctors determined Sayal suffered from chronic brain damage. Chris and her husband, Paul, came to the decision they wouldn't let any of their four kids play football. She says it was a difficult conversation telling their oldest son, Ben, a multi-sport athlete, that he wouldn't play.
He really did want to play football. He really wanted to be a running back and play. And it was a hard discussion, but we just had to be the parents, and we just had to say no. It wasn't going to be his decision.
Peacock says her son found joy in soccer, track, and basketball without as many health risks.
No regrets at all. He's great at soccer. He's great at basketball. I think he's getting a lot of fulfillment from those sports. And I think, you know, there's always going to be risks, but I think the risks are lower in those sports.
As for their younger boys working their way through grade school, even flag football won't be an option for them.
I totally would support flag football, except they feel like that's a gateway to real football, so we've been steering them away from that.
Flag football, by design, is a gateway to tackle football. Most young people who start playing the non-tackle version end up playing tackle football later. If youth football is the foundation on which the sport is built, the game is still on solid ground in Bloomington Normal, which has had a thriving program for decades. Children and their parents can easily be drawn to the Friday Night Lights atmosphere. At Ewing Park 2, where the Bloomington Cardinals play their home games, helmet-clad kids ages 8 to 13, decked out in full shoulder pads, engage in their ritualistic pep talks, mimicking the ones they see on television, then storm onto the field by tearing through a sign amid thick, fake red smoke and AC/DC pumping in the background. And cheerleaders capturing the attention of cheering fans who camp under tents lining the field in all directions. At White Oak Park, where the Bloomington Knockers play their home games, an inflated helmet is their prop of choice as players enter the field. Knockers director Brian Segabiano is the third generation in his family that has helped keep the Knockers in business for more than 60 years. He says it's all part of the game and fan experience that has helped keep youth football so popular, even as more parents express worries about their children's safety. Segabiano says he wants to take a proactive approach.
You address it. You don't bury your head in the sand. You say, okay, there's a concern. What are the things that they have some valid points about? And you address it because it's an important sport to us. It's taught a lot of us a lot of lessons outside of the field.
Segabiano says youth football in Bloomington Normal has banned kickoffs, a play considered one of the most dangerous in the game because of the risk for full-speed collisions. He adds that coaches are teaching safer tackling techniques, specifically avoiding helmet contact when possible. Lyle Edwards and his wife Diane have been running the Bloomington Cardinals youth football program for decades. He believes the game is safer than it's ever been, but doesn't believe better helmets are the answer.
I don't care what kind of helmet you buy. Helmets are only designed for incidental contact. They're not designed to use as a battering ram. The two things happen. You can get a concussion that way, or you can get a neck injury.
Edward says in the 1970s and 80s, neck injuries were far more common because players often led with their head. Diane Edwards jokes she's the Cardinals' co-director by marriage. She says the kids in the program all submit to baseline concussion tests that include a neurocognitive assessment that's used to determine whether a child is safe to return to play after a potential head injury.
We also offer our kids impact testing every year. The Cardinals pay for that because we think it's that important.
Lyle Edwards suggests much of the fear over football is simply a fear of the unknown, which he likened to the public's misunderstanding about guns.
All the younger people don't own guns. All the younger people are concerned about the health of their kids. The older people are when we all die out and understand if you teach somebody how to use a gun right, it's safe. If you teach somebody how to play football right, it's safer. It's not safe. Nothing is safe.
Edwards laments ongoing efforts to change football will eventually lead to a game either changing beyond recognition or going away altogether.
I think someday they'll be gone. I don't think I'll see it.
But he says that would be a shame.
What do you want them to do if you don't have youth sports? You want to sit them in front of a TV and play video games? That's not good. You want them just running around the neighborhood, out in front of cars.
When coaches or school administrators in McLean County have medical concerns about concussions, they call Edward Pegg III. Dr. Pegg is a Bloomington-based neurologist at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center and runs a private practice. Pegg says he first became interested in studying links between football and head injuries when his son played at Normal West High School.
I actually witnessed Ed having a concussion on the field. He wasn't knocked out, but when I saw him walking towards the goalpost rather than back to the huddle, I knew, you know, something was going on.
Pegg has been providing concussion baseline tests for youth, high school, and college football players in Bloomington, Normal, and beyond for years. His son, Dr. Edward Pegg IV, followed in his father's footsteps into neurology. And in 2015, he presented research to the American Academy of Neurology. He studied brain scans of retired NFL players and neuropsychiatric evaluations of retirees who had suffered repeated concussions to detect changes in their brain's health. Peg the Fourth says the MRIs revealed changes in brain activity likely resulted from multiple head injuries.
Having repeated head trauma over a period of years is probably not good in the long term.
The senior Peg is a season ticket holder for Illinois State football, but says he's not a hardcore fan. He acknowledges the health risks that football can pose, but he believes the constant drumbeat from the media about concussions has caused the pendulum to swing too far in the other direction.
You know, if we've got a lot of henny pennies out there, you know, freaking out about every little thing that happens, it may not swing back to the middle.
Peg believes most pro football players have likely suffered anywhere from 20 to 50 undiagnosed concussions in their careers, a number that someone playing only high school or college will likely never reach.
You hear all the bad things and nobody has gone, now look, these are 300-plus pound players that are slamming into each other at over 15 miles an hour. I mean, that's a lot more of, you know, causes the brain to slosh around a lot more.
The senior Peg acknowledges he'd prefer to see kids waiting until they're older to play football. That's a decision the younger Peg will soon face. He has three young children now, all playing soccer, and Peg says he hopes they stay with soccer if his 7-year-old son decides he wants to play football.
I think I would be okay with that. I think that, you know, if he was showing that he was having repetitive injuries, then I'd be like, well, we got to rethink this. But to play, you know, in high school is one thing. To do it as a lifelong career, I would be a little bit more hesitant to, you know, encourage that.
While the effects football has on the brain may never be fully known, perceptions about the sport's dangers have the attention of the Illinois High School Association, the privately run organization which oversees high school sports in the state. Craig Anderson is its executive director. His devotion to football runs deep. He played in the sport from 6th grade through college. He later coached football at the high school level and coached his own kids in youth football. Anderson believes caretakers of the game have made great strides to make it safer.
I can honestly sit here and say I think the game's the safest it's ever been in terms of equipment and technique and the things that our coaches are doing to protect kids.
The IHSA has also limited full contact drills during practices. Anderson acknowledges concerns about players' safety are likely the driving force in reducing participation in football, but he suggests increased specialization of younger athletes has prompted more of them to focus on one sport year-round in hopes of earning a college scholarship.
When there's money being invested, then there's somebody making money out of it. So, you know, those trainers are promoting those kids to come and participate in these out of our high school season leagues and development plans or programs that, you know, kids might find their ways to get better, but, you know, they're losing out on opportunities to participate for their high school.
Few football coaches are more familiar with the challenges facing high schools than Mike Castleman. He coached Lexington's last football team and is now the athletic director at Olympia High School, yet another rural district with a shrinking population. He says he has seen high school football suffer from many student-athletes only wanting to play one sport with the thought it would make them more successful. Castleman considers that flawed thinking. He says spending too much time on one sport is often counterproductive to becoming a complete athlete.
Ohio State a couple years ago had a thing where it was 90 to 95% of their squad were all multi-sport athletes in high school. It's what the next level is looking for, but for some reason we're not getting on board with that.
The increased specialization of youth in high school sports has increased injury risks, according to Cynthia LaBella, professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She spoke to IPR's The 21st.
There are a few studies that suggest that, especially with sports that require repetition of one specific movement over and over again to perfect a skill. So there is some concern that overuse injuries are becoming more prevalent because there is not as much downtime for the body to repair tissues and recover and heal.
The increased likelihood of injuries can lead to an increased likelihood of litigation. Hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits have been filed against university athletic programs claiming schools lack proper concussion protocols. Joe Walters is in his first season as head coach at Central Catholic High School in Bloomington. Walters cautioned that a legal challenge of some kind could accelerate more drastic changes to the game.
You know, it could happen overnight if there was some type of significant change and we weren't able to obtain insurance anymore. Otherwise, I do think it will slowly. And I think that's our responsibility as adults and coaches, that we got to protect our players and our children. So if we're not doing that, well, then shame on us.
Mike Castleman says Olympia's football program is starting to rebound, but he acknowledged the uphill battle his program and the sport faces long term. Aside from the threat of injuries, Castleman worries some young people are turned off playing football simply because of the commitment that's required.
I don't want to offend anybody with anything, but you know, football is it's hard. It just is. The preparation is hard. It's a hard game to play. And some people, for the choices that they have, just are not willing to do that.
Castleman adds those sacrifices he made playing football in high school and college were well worth it.
When I talk with guys from high school, I don't mean to offend the math teachers, but we don't talk about what happened in math class. We talked about football, and we still do these many years later.
But athletic administrators know there is one math problem they will have to solve. If current participation declines in football continue in 30 years, sounds like this might become sounds of the past. I'm Eric Stahl.
And what I seen was this whole raft of people a-setting on these two banks and a-looking at one another across this pretty little green cow pasture. Well, they was. And somebody had took and drawed white lines all over it and drove posties in it and I don't know what all. And I looked down there and I seen five or six convicts a-running up and down and a-blowing whistles. They was. And then I looked.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're looking back on some of the sports stories GLT brought you this year. Alan Madfeet Higgins has joined an elite group of marathon runners. He's now completed his 50th 26.2-mile run, at least one in all 50 states. The latest came in Springfield, Illinois, earlier this year. The 56-year-old Higgins became one of about 1,400 runners in the United States to complete the task. GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth spoke with the New York native at the Golden K Kiwanis Club in Bloomington about his journey.
My 74th marathon, 50th state. So it's been an amazing journey, and I've met some amazing people along the way. It started in 1998 in Orlando, Florida, the Disney World Marathon, and I didn't have the intention of running all 50 states. It just kind of just happened. I drove up to Georgia, ran one. Before I knew it, I had several different states along the way. Then I found out about the 50 State Club, and they said, "Well, if you get 10 states, you can become a member of this club." And I finally, by 2013, I had the 10th state, and I just I would go online and find different states, and before you know it, 20 years later, I finally completed it.
And you say there's how many people in the...
There's about a little over 4,500 members, but only about 1,400 of us have completed all 50 states. And it's just... obviously, there's many reasons why it takes... Some people, finances is a huge part of this, because you've got airfare, hotels, rental cars. It's a very expensive sport to be in. So,
what would you say that roughly the cost, you say?
Well, once I started having to fly to these events, each marathon was costing me about $1,200 to $1,500 per race. So, and like Hawaii was probably close to $5,000, and Alaska the same. So, the more west I went, the more the price went up. So,
And obviously a lot of running shoes
in the
process.
Yeah, running shoes I go through a lot because I'm what they call a heel striker. When I come down, when my foot hits the pavement, I kind of come down on my heel, which wears the soles out a lot faster. And being at close to 200 pounds, I'm a heavy runner. So it's like tires on your car. You wear them down faster if it's a heavy vehicle. Or it's just, I'd say I can get maybe 6 weeks out of a pair of running shoes. 6 to 8 weeks. And that's, you know, anywhere from, I try to find discounts, but anywhere from $100 to $150 a pair of shoes.
Has running always been a part of your life?
It has. It really has. I started running when I was 18, just prior to me joining the Navy. It was my way of releasing, finding myself, just my thoughts, getting my inner thoughts.
And you said after running the first marathon, you were hooked.
I was hooked. My first marathon was my fastest, 3 hours and 47 minutes. And I had basically old shoes, running shoes. I really didn't know what I was doing. But it's been an amazing journey.
And I understand that you kind of took this challenge on to honor your mother.
Yes, I ran a marathon in Jacksonville, Florida, breast cancer awareness marathon. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1985. And she survived it. Luckily, thank God she survived it. But breast cancer to me is near and dear to my heart. It's an organization where I've supported my whole entire life. I have friends. We all know someone who's had breast cancer. And if I can just, my gift is my feet. I can run. I can raise money. I've raised a lot of money for it. So yeah, it's.
You grew up in New York, correct?
Long Island, New York. Yes.
And Illinois just happened to be the last state for you, or was it a plan?
No, it wasn't. I drove to all the states that I could get to by a car, and then I flew to all the states on the West Coast, and the country just started closing in, and it just seemed to happen that Illinois was the last state.
Was the Jacksonville Marathon then your most memorable, or was yesterday your most memorable?
I would have to say yesterday, because I had my family. I had all my family at the finish line waiting for me to finish. A lot of these races, I just go off by myself and do them. But yesterday my son put the medal around my neck, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house yesterday.
Now I understand you ran 6 marathons in 6 straight days.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I there's a club called the Mainly Marathons where they put on these races specifically for the 50 state guys like us and girls. We run multiple states. It was North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Nebraska, and someone else. But yeah, I would literally run a marathon, getting my rent a car, drive to the next state. They were all border states, cities. So I zigzagged to each state. No state was no more than 200 miles away. We just kind of, it was a long, my feet were very swollen at the end.
You don't train to run marathons like a normal marathon
runner, correct? I'm always marathon ready, if that's, because I'm, I could probably go out and run a marathon in a few days if I have to. So, yeah, I'm running a marathon in Cocoa, Florida, the last week in November. So, and that'll be my 75th marathon.
What's the goal?
There is no goal. I would like to run as long as I can, as long as I stay healthy. I just enjoy running. I want to go up to Canada and I run all the provinces. And I want to continue to raise money for great causes. So
you really don't actually do training. You're training constantly just by running.
I go to the gym 3 times a week. I do run probably two days a week, but it's nothing like... I do run a long run on Sundays, anywhere between 15 to 18 miles, but my body's pretty much conditioned to go that distance, that 26.2 miles. And that's why my times, if I really focused on my training and my weight, I could be back up there running competitively. But I'd rather be back in the pack where it's more fun, actually.
How long did it take you in running the marathons to realize that enjoy the moment rather than win the race?
That's a great question. I ran several marathons in the sub-4s, which is it's a pretty fast pace. And one year I just realized that I'm not having fun anymore. So, and the reason was because I was running hard and I wasn't enjoying it anymore. So I backed my time off substantially. And everyone in the back of the pack, the 5 hour to 5.5 hour group, they were just having a great time. And I was actually being able to take time and take pictures while I'm running. And I've got a lot of memories. I can remember my later marathons, and the ones that I ran hard, I really have no memory of them.
You talked about the highlights and the most memorable marathons.
Yes.
You got some lowlights in the marathon?
Atlantic City sticks out of my mind. It was a horrible windy day that day, and the wind gusts were 40, 50 miles an hour. It felt like I was running in place. I just felt like I wasn't getting any forward momentum. And that was it wasn't such a nice city either, so.
What about the Montana Marathon?
Montana, I have a funny story about Montana. I was driving into Montana, and I saw the Welcome to Montana sign. So I get out of my rental car, and I shut the door, and I walk up to the sign, take a picture of the Welcome to Montana sign, and then I go back to my car, and the car door's locked. And then the back door's locked. All four doors are locked. The car is running. So I go, what do I do? So I called the rental car company. They were 4 hours away. AAA was, they said, we'll be by tomorrow to get you. Because I'm in the middle of nowhere. So I called 911. And the operator goes, well, we have one state trooper, and he's 3 hours away. So I leaned up against a fence post with barbed wire and just waited 3 hours for the state trooper, and he popped the lock in about 30 seconds. True story.
Your nickname's Mad Feet.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Several years back, I suffered severely from plantar fasciitis, and I was ready to give up my running career because I couldn't walk. So I was always complaining about my feet hurting me, and all my members from the marathon group were saying, you know, we're just going to start calling you Mad Feet all the time. So that's how the nickname Mad Feet came. But now I should be Happy Feet.
Alan Madfeet Higgins spoke with GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth at the Golden K Kiwanis Club in Bloomington. It took Higgins 20 years to complete the 1,300-mile trek. He now lives in Orlando, Florida.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, with Doctors Brownstone, Crockett, Pinter, and Vise, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for more than 30 years. Routine vision care also available. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is a sporty edition of Sound Ideas on New Year's Eve. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coaches are often defined by wins and losses, but a Bloomington man who became a head coach in the most unlikely of ways at age 21 already has a significant victory to his name. He's defeated cancer twice. GLT's Eric Stock introduces us to Jake Wagner.
Wagner was a senior at Normal Community High School in February of 2015, a few months ahead of graduation, had a bright career in college where he was planning to continue his baseball career. Then his life changed forever.
You know, I just wasn't feeling right one day and stayed home from school for a few days. And then finally went to go get a checkup at my doctor's office, and they originally thought it was like mono because I had a big like bulge in my stomach. But then we did some testing and like an ultrasound, and they knew it was more serious than that. So they sent me to Peoria, the St. Jude Clinic in Peoria. And they found out it was a cancerous tumor in my stomach, and had to have surgery a few days later. And it was a 10-pound tumor the size of a football removed from my abdomen. Which they found out to be neuroblastoma.
So what's going through your mind as the doctor is explaining this to you and your family?
I mean, I was a little more calm probably than my parents were. I'm sure, it's very hard on a parent to hear that about their child. But, I was just staying calm in the moment and wasn't afraid of anything. You know, no thoughts racing through my mind. The only thing that was racing through my mind was, oh, man, I'm going to miss – school and my baseball season. That's really what I was thinking about, which in the scheme of things wasn't, the biggest thing to miss out on. But
at your age, people tend to think they're indestructible. They don't think about the long term or their fallibility, I suppose. Is that sort of where you were at?
Right. I'd really never gotten sick. So hearing the word cancer, that scares you. Because you see it on TV all the time. You can see physical symptoms of people. It can scare you. But in that moment, I wasn't too worried about things. I didn't really know a whole lot in that moment originally.
What kind of prognosis did they give you, or did they know?
Well, the fact that I'd always stay healthy and, work out and play sports, that helps my health. The thing that scared them, my doctors, was that neuroblastoma usually occurs in children 0 to 5 years old, and so getting it at the age of 18 was very rare and very unique. But they had a treatment plan for it, so that's what kept me confident in the fact that I trusted my doctors there at St. Jude, and the fact that they had confidence in the treatment plan for me really kept me calm and my parents calm.
Hi, I'm Matt Wegner. I'm Jacob's father.
Hi, I'm Lisa Wegner. I'm Jake's mom.
I'm sure it's a moment that will be forever with you, where you were when you found out that your son had been diagnosed with cancer. Can you take me back to that moment and what was going through your minds as parents?
Actually, Lisa and I were out of town. We were moving our daughter into an internship in Florida. And a good friend of ours, Bill Bauman, was actually the gentleman who took Jake to the doctor, to Dr. Weaver's office, and where he started doing tests and examinations of Jacob. And we made our way home from Florida as quickly as we could driving, but it was definitely a life-changing experience.
We didn't find out he had cancer till after we had gotten home from our trip, but we knew that something was very wrong. And so, we were very concerned, and the fact we weren't there, didn't settle real well with us, so it was a little scary.
And in talking to Jake, and this might be an oversimplification, but he seems to have taken it all in stride, figuring that he had faith in the doctors, they knew what they were doing, they had a plan, and he was going to put his faith in them and carry it through.
That would be exactly correct. It wasn't an oversimplification. Jake made the process very, very easy as he expressed his faith in God. And his love for his family and his faith in his doctors, and just was always very positive, has always been and remains very positive about his struggles with cancer and getting back and becoming the healthy baseball player he's always wanted to be.
We were able to stay really strong because Jake would tell us, he said to me when the doctor said, we didn't know he had cancer yet, but then when the doctor said you have a large mass on your abdomen, it might be cancer. And Jake could tell that I was pretty upset by that. And he said, Mom, he said, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. And so, that helped us. We just stayed strong for him because we knew that he was, he was, his faith was strong and that mentally he was good. So we felt like, okay, well, I'll deal with this together.
And now he's cancer-free and coaching again, hoping to one day play again once the pain completely goes away. How optimistic are you that he's going to get that opportunity again?
We stay optimistic about it. He's still, his body's still repairing from all the treatment. But, even if it's a couple years from now that he gets to play, that would be great. But, we know there's the possibility he might not ever play again, but I think he's okay with that.
Jake went through months of cancer treatments, first in the winter of 2015 during his senior year of high school, then again in early 2016 after a cancer relapse, which doctors determined was stage 4 neuroblastoma. He had to drop out of school at Central College in Pella, Iowa, because the treatments were so intense. He lost close to 30 pounds twice and has nearly gained it all back. Doctors ruled him cancer-free in May of last year. while this was going on, baseball was probably the farthest thing from your mind, or at least you knew that it wasn't anything that you were going to be able to get back to, whether as a player or as a coach. When did that start to come back to you to where you thought, well, maybe I can get back to playing again someday?
Well, I always have had it in the back of my mind just because I love the game of baseball. But again, it's just a game in reality. So it's not the most important thing in life, but I am a competitor, and that's one of the reasons why I do fight every day to keep improving my health and getting stronger, because I do want to come back, and the comeback is going to be so great. I hope this doesn't sound selfish, but it'll be a great story when I finally can step back on that field and play again. But since at the moment I can't play, obviously, coaching this summer and being close to the game is important.
As fate would have it, Jake got an unexpected call from a coach he had known since he was 9 years old.
Hi, I'm Mike Brown. I'm the general manager of the Bloomington Bobcats.
So in the third year of the Bobcats' return to the Midwest Collegiate League, you turned to a 21-year-old coach who had never coached or managed before to take over this program. You obviously knew something about Jake and figured that he would be a good fit.
If you didn't know Jake, I could see where it would look like a little bit of a leap of faith. But knowing him, knowing what a strong kid he is, what a strong will he has, because, the season is a grind. I mean, it's 50-some-odd games. He has tremendous baseball knowledge, love of the game. So to me, it was a perfect fit. I just took a little talking him into it to get it, but it's worked out great.
So what was his reaction when you first posed the idea?
I think he thought I was kidding. I really think he thought I was kidding. And, I think there was some reluctance on his part, not sure if, with guys being his age, if that would work. But it's worked great. The guys love him, and he's done a really good job.
As someone who seems to be a little more understated, a little more reserved than you typically see from a lot of the fiery baseball managers, how has his style fit the game coaching kids who are about his age?
I think it works well because they are his age. I'm not sure how they would take it if he was, up in their grill so much as they might take it from somebody who's older. They know what a good baseball mind he is, and I think there's a lot of respect in that. And I think the fact that he is understated about it, and he's out here to throw BP to him every day if they want it. He hits in and out if they want it. So he's doing a lot of things to help them get better, and they respect and appreciate that.
Okay, Mitch.
The Bloomington Bobcats play in a wooden bat summer league of college-age players. Despite Wagner's age and his often calm demeanor, Wagner instantly earned the respect of his players, including Garrett Shea, a junior at Illinois Wesleyan University.
It was a little shocking at first. I was like, because I forgot the story, and then it clicked, like, who it was, and it was really compelling and, like, inspirational, really, that he's out here doing this, and he's been a really good coach.
Billy Moat played against Wagner back in the seventh grade and later in high school.
It's a different perspective for him, but I was just beyond excited to be a part of it. Having him back, he's patient. He's a great guy, always has been. And obviously, he's the strongest guy I know. And, he's brought that to the team.
The GM, Brown, says he looks forward to the day when Wagner will take the field again, not as a coach.
I look forward to hopefully getting to watch him play the outfield as a Bobcat, down the road. I hope that's coming. But in the meantime, we're just focused on winning this league this summer. And I know that's his goal. That's my goal. And, seeing the smile on his face makes it all worthwhile.
So you're saving a roster spot for him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He already has his jersey.
And for Wagner's part, he's not sure when that day will come, but his battle overcoming cancer has taught him a lot about himself.
Two things which kind of relate to each other. One, just how strong I am in my faith, because I just always know that God has a plan for me, and that there was a purpose for me going through all this treatment and enduring this. And then the thing that goes along with that is just finding my perspective, having great perspective in life. And what is most important, and the most important thing to me is, my health, and I realize that now. And so now little things that maybe used to bother me in the past don't really bother me on a daily basis.
What do you think your purpose is now?
to share the good news of St. Jude and all the good that they do, and help others going through tough times in life, whether it is going through cancer treatments. You know, I've talked with other cancer patients to help them through their treatment, or just other people who are struggling in life. They will reach out to me and ask for advice. And so I found that as one of my purposes for going through all this.
St. Jude covers the cost of all treatment for its patients. I'm Eric Staw.
Jake Wagner has also been helping the coaching staff at Central College with hopes he'll be able to play college baseball. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. This is Sound Ideas. Wheelchair tennis has been around for more than four decades, but has only recently come to Bloomington Normal. GLT's Willis Kern has more on a demonstration event in the Twin Cities.
Okay, we'd like to get started. I am thrilled that we have this many people and this many folks in chairs to play. We're going to start off with a demonstration.
Suanne Guess Hansen has never used a wheelchair, but the retired Metcalf school teacher worked with many children who did. So she naturally wants to see people with disabilities succeed in all facets of life, including sports. As a current volunteer for the United States Tennis Association's Midwest Diversity Wheelchair and Adaptive Tennis Program, Guess Hansen decided to organize a wheelchair tennis demonstration event in Bloomington. 50 people, some in wheelchairs, show up at Evergreen Racquet Club. A team of four wheelchair tennis players and a coach have traveled from Western Indiana to show how wheelchair athletes can compete with their so-called able-bodied colleagues, some of whom are teammates, others opponents. There have been wheelchair tennis players in Bloomington before, but Colleen Curran, Evergreen Racquet Club's general manager, says this demonstration event marks a turning point for the club.
We are community service oriented, and we also have a strong belief in tennis for everyone, all inclusive, no matter abilities, levels, age. This fits in perfectly into our mission and what we'd like to offer to members of the community.
Participation by athletes in wheelchairs has skyrocketed worldwide, increasing 11-fold since fewer than 400 took part in the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. According to Paralympic.org, there were nearly 4,300 wheelchair athletes at the London Olympics in 2012 and about 4,350 at Rio in 2016. The sport of wheelchair tennis was the brainchild of Californian Brad Parks, who worked with friends to establish a competitive program after a skiing accident left him paralyzed from the hips down.
In 1980, 4 years after my accident, started this national organization to promote wheelchair tennis and get more people to know about it and just give it a shot to see if you could develop a sport from nothing, and kind of grew into what it is today.
Today, there are more than 50,000 wheelchair tennis players around the world. In addition to the Paralympic Games, there are wheelchair championships associated with all four Grand Slam tennis tournaments. Parks is among the most decorated wheelchair tennis players ever, holding the sport's number one ranking during the 1980s and winning three Grand Slam titles and a gold medal at the 1992 Barcelona Paralympics.
When we started sport, we felt like, how do we tell people about a sport that they'd never heard of? Most people think it's impossible to play back in those days. So the best way to do that is through these demonstrations. And you get a couple of great players, they demonstrate, maybe help out with a clinic, and you teach people how to play, and that's how the sport grows. So I think they're critical.
There are nearly 200 competitive events worldwide that regularly schedule U.S. professional tennis players. Jason Allen, who heads up wheelchair tennis for the USTA, says one reason is, besides using wheelchairs, the game doesn't change much.
The only difference between able-bodied tennis and wheelchair tennis is that wheelchair tennis athletes can have two bounces. Everything else is the same. So we are completely integrated into the able-bodied world.
This slight rule variation allows wheelchair athletes to compete on the same court and in the same match as able-bodied players. Sherry Hildebrand is an instructional assistant professor in therapeutic recreation at Illinois State University and helped organize the demonstration event in Bloomington. She says the smooth integration of wheelchair players makes the sport inclusive.
I could be in a wheelchair playing wheelchair tennis, and my partner playing doubles with me could be standing. You don't have to have just wheelchair tennis or just standing tennis. You can have up-down tennis where you've got a person with a wheelchair and person without a wheelchair playing together on the same team.
My name is Julia Farrell. I want to become famous, and please make my dream come true. Thank you.
14-year-old Julia Farrell tinkered on her phone while her dad, Kevin, drove the 88 miles to Bloomington from Hinckley in DeKalb County. Kevin Farrell says Julia has spina bifida, a birth defect where there is incomplete closing of the backbone and membranes around the spinal cord. He says it limits her mobility.
But here, with the wheelchair, she can be like anybody else and play like anybody else because she has a very she's very strong. She's very coordinated.
Oh. Ready? Here we go.
Yeah. Oh, look at that!
Look at that! Excellent. Good job. Just the fact that you're moving the wheelchair and then able to get to the ball and stroke and hit it is really good.
One of the demonstration team players lets Julia borrow her wheelchair while running the 14-year-old through a set of basic drills. Dawn Crawford of Schurville, Indiana, suffered a spinal cord injury from a fall in 2000. She started playing wheelchair tennis about 10 years ago as a way to enjoy sports with her children. Crawford says Julia seems a natural for the sport because she's so well coordinated.
She cannot move well, so for her to be in a wheelchair playing tennis would be better for her. She won't be able to get any balls standing. So if she's in a chair, so she has to learn the movement of the chair, and then she combines that with the strokes that she knows, and she's on her way.
Julia's dad, Kevin, who has taught tennis, wonders about things like wheelchair costs and access to programs and other players. But Dawn Crawford says grants can help pay for equipment, and if Julia wants to play with just about anybody else, there's nothing to stop her.
There are players out there that have started young and played from, say, her age on, and they've played on their high school teams as a wheelchair player against able-bodied kids. So it is possible.
Some observers of wheelchair tennis say the players' ability to compete on a court with able-bodied athletes inspires them. But demonstration team coach Julie Fritz says some wheelchair athletes take exception to that notion.
They're just people that happen to sit every day instead of walk, and that's how they see themselves. So being able to play wheelchair tennis is just being able to play tennis to them.
Wheelchair tennis founder Brad Parks agrees with that to a point, but says it's only natural that great athletes are inspirational, especially when they've endured so much.
Some people watch the Olympics because of the up close and personals. And the up close and personals in the Paralympics are so much better and so much more interesting and inspiring and everything else because of what these athletes have been through.
Right now, funding and other issues have put the United States behind other nations in competitive wheelchair tennis. But Park says he's hopeful that will change soon.
Right now, the best players are from Europe, but I'd love to see more great Americans come up. And I'd love hearing stories about this 14-year-old gal who is introduced to wheelchair tennis. And that's kind of how the sport grows and develops. And who knows, this gal could end up being, you know, a great American player, but she may not. It may be just be an encouragement. But that's the beauty of the sport.
Organizers say they're hopeful this successful demonstration in Bloomington could lead to more events like it, helping spread awareness and the growth of wheelchair tennis. I'm Willis Kern, WGLT News.
If you might have noticed while the players were playing, when we were just warming up, their chairs were moving a lot when they weren't hitting the ball. There's a reason for that. Have you ever tried to ride a bike on a hill? And if you stop in the middle of the hill, it's hard to get going again. So as a coach, I yell at my players when they're not moving. So when they're not hitting the ball, they should be moving. So keep an eye for that and let me know if anybody's not doing what they're supposed to do down there.
You're listening to some of the year's significant sports stories from the GLT Newsroom in this New Year's Eve edition of Sound Ideas. Lacrosse is a Native American game. Originating on the East Coast in the 1700s, it has slowly made its way to the Midwest. Small colleges such as Illinois Wesleyan University are using it to stay competitive in recruiting students. Now, even high schools are picking it up. GLT's Brian Bloodworth reports.
That's not the sound of Illinois Wesleyan's football team taking the field. It's the Titans men's lacrosse team before a recent game. Men's team coach Zach Iannucci says IWU was not an early adopter or a late comer.
We were
kind of in the middle of when the school started. We're in our fifth year, so we were a little bit later. It's really grown fast.
Lacrosse is a team sport played with a hollowed metal stick that varies in length with a butterfly net type glove on the end. The players use the stick to carry, pass, catch, control, and shoot the 2-ounce soft rubber lacrosse ball into the opposing team's goal. Iannucci says each goal is worth 1 point.
I guess you'd call it like a mix of many sports. So you got hockey in there, you've got some football, some soccer. It's fast, it's physical, it's a lot of fun to play, a lot of fun to watch. Hockey's probably the closest that if someone doesn't know the sport.
The games last an hour. Will Harris is a freshman goalie for the Titans.
It's called the fastest sport on 2 feet for a reason, and it's fast-paced, lots of goals, lots of excitement.
Harris began playing the sport in third grade. He says the speed of the game makes it fun.
There's so many parts of it that are fun, but being a goalie, kind of last line of defense, is something that I've always got like an adrenaline rush from it. But playing goalie, I mean, you got to have some kind of crazy to step in cage. Brutal position. Bruised and battered all over, from taking shots off the knee, taking shots off the thigh, arms, all over the place. Labor of love.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
Senior midfielder Nick Winter says the 110-yard, 65-foot men's field basically has three sections.
Defensive end, you have three attackmen that have to stay on the offensive end. Then you have three midfielders who can run the length of the field, and then you have defenders who have to stay on their defensive ends.
Players wear shoulder and elbow pads, gloves, and helmets. Coach Iannucci says it gets physical.
It's more of a contact sport, not a collision sport. Like, football is very much a collision sport. There is contact. Like, you can hit each other with your stick. So you see some big hits sometimes, but, like, a couple in a game, not like football where it's every play. It's a much safer, just because it's not the goal of each play to take somebody to the ground.
Let's go, Jay!
Oh yeah, Jay! Oh yeah, Jay!
Full contact is a feature of the men's game, but not so much in the women's game. Lindsay Keller coaches the women for Wesleyan.
There's a little bit of contact, so we can make contact. Your stick can't touch their body, but you can put contact on from a defensive positioning point of view with your body and their body. So it's kind of similar, I would say, to the contact that you may see in basketball.
Keller says there are other differences in the women's game. For one, the field is 120 yards long, there is a 90-second possession clock, and 12 players are on the field rather than 10.
I don't know where the difference is started at. With the Native Americans starting the sport, they were all men. Only males played it. In Scotland is where they started kind of the women's side, and so I think the games have been very different.
Keller, like Iannucci, grew up and played lacrosse in college on the East Coast.
Zach equated men's lacrosse more to hockey, where it's a little bit quicker like that. Women's lacrosse is growing to be quicker. We've actually just introduced a possession clock, which has sped the game up a little bit. It's faster than soccer, but it's not quite as fast as men's lacrosse.
Players from across the country sprinkle the men's and women's rosters, but Iannucci says the majority hail from the Chicago suburbs.
We do a lot of our recruiting out of the suburbs, and the sport has grown, and the level of player has really grown as well, and that's been really helpful for us as we've continued to grow our program.
Keller says the girls' game is growing as well.
One thing that we compete with in the state of Illinois is that soccer is in the same season, whereas in other states it's not. You know, if that ever changes, that would be really nice, and I think we'd get more interest from the girls' side.
No high schools in the Bloomington-Normal area currently field lacrosse teams, but the sport is growing throughout Illinois. Matt Troha of the Illinois High School Association says the IHSA added it to the state tournament series this year.
When we looked at the youth numbers that U.S. lacrosse gave us, there's been a several-year span where they're just doubling year over year, especially in Illinois and the Midwest. So we just kind of looked at that and said, hey, the numbers are here. These kids are playing, and they're going to be in high school soon. And, you know, to provide them that participation opportunity is something we wanted to do.
In this year's state tournament series, 78 boys and 58 girls teams played for championships. The only downstate schools are Dunlap on the boys' side and O'Fallon on the girls' side. Troha says the IHSA expects more teams next year.
We're excited about the growth. The Peoria area looks like it could have as many as 3 to 4 teams as early as next year. You know, we anticipate Bloomington Normal area should have a team. You know, we think the Quad Cities will, Springfield, Champaign did in the past, and we expect that to come back.
How soon does Troha see a team from Bloomington Normal in the state series?
I would hope in maybe 3 years, probably 5 maybe is a safe estimate. But I would be really surprised if they're not a high school team there within 5 years.
Both Iannucci and Keller say the games are appealing.
You'll love it if you watch it. You might not have any idea what's going on at first, but I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's a really lot of fun.
Again, like in hockey, you may not know all the rules or why they're doing certain things, but it catches on and it's fast moving and it's exciting, which I think is probably the best part, is that it's a faster sport.
I'm Brian Bloodwood.
There are currently a combined 150 male and female lacrosse players, ranging in age from 10 and under through high school, in the Bloomington Warriors Club organization. Thanks for listening to this New Year's Eve edition of 2018 Sports Stories on Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Let's go out with Manfred Mann and his Earth Band. Happy New Year. Pass on the